Do you remember the song at the very start of the celebrated Broadway musical 1776, Sit Down, John? Partway through, Congress sings, "Someone ought to open up a window." No, no, too many flies, too many flies. But it's hot as hell in Philadelphia. Someone ought to open up a window. Can't we compromise?
Someone ought to open up a window.
Someone ought to open up a window. Can't we compromise here? We're left with the feeling, aren't we, that if Congress can't agree on opening a window at Independence Hall, then what are the chances they'll agree on independence from Britain? A funny musical moment of theater, but very true to history. The flies, I mean. Here's what we learn from Dr. William Cachetus as he walks us through the streets of Philadelphia, taking us along with Thomas Jefferson. He writes, "Thomas Jefferson arrived in Philadelphia from his Monticello plantation on May 14, 1776, having been appointed to the Virginia delegation of the Second Continental Congress the previous year. Jefferson had already established a residence at 4th and Chestnut Streets in the house of cabinet maker Benjamin Randolph. It was a convenient location, just a block away from the Pennsylvania State House, where Congress held its proceedings. With Benjamin Franklin's courtyard next door, the Virginian could also enjoy the hospitality of Philadelphia's most prominent citizen. The only disadvantage, as Jefferson saw it, was that the neighborhood was congested with houses, stables, and tanneries, which produced an almost constant stream of fetid odors and pesky flies. Unwilling to spend another summer in those miserable conditions, Jefferson began looking for lodgings on the outskirts of town, where, as he put it, I may have the benefit of a freely circulating air. His search took him to a recently built brick house on the southwest corner of 7th and Market Streets, owned by one Jacob or Jacob Graf Jr., a local brickmaker. Located away from the noise and bustle of the city, the Graf house would be an ideal place for Jefferson to relax and concentrate on the considerable writing he would have to do for Congress. On May 23rd, Jefferson rented the second floor of the new 3.5-story brick house for the rate of 35 shillings per week. He would occupy the already furnished parlor and bedroom, while his enslaved valet, Robert Hemings, slept in a storage space at the top of the house. Content with his accommodations, the Virginia delegate remained until September 3rd, 1776, the day of his departure for Monticello. It was at the Graf House between June 11th and June 28th that Thomas Jefferson wrote one of the greatest documents in human history, one that continues to inspire people around the world to fight for freedom and equality, that he wrote the Declaration of Independence while residing at a Philadelphia brickmaker's house reminds us that the extraordinary achievements of our lives and our world often take place in the most ordinary places. Words of William Cachetus from his new book, Independence National Historical Park, An Insider's History. Dr. Cachetus knows the park intimately. He visited there when he was a lad with his family, and he eventually became a seasonal park ranger while studying for his doctorate at the University of Pennsylvania. He tells us, as a teacher in Philadelphia prep schools and later as a college professor, I took my students on walking tours of the park, Often I dressed as Thomas Paine, the radical journalist who authored Common Sense, and engaged those students with stories of the other founding fathers who resided, albeit briefly, in the city. After retiring from a 35-year teaching career, I returned to Independence National Historical Park as a volunteer interpreter and to research and write about the history of those landmark sites. His new book, Independence National Historical Park, An Insider's History, contains the results of all those years living the history of those places, foundational to the nation, and sharing what he has discovered over the years with others. Dr. Cachetas paid a visit to the WVIA studios to introduce us freshly to Independence National Historical Park as someone with roots right here in northeastern Pennsylvania.
I was raised in northeastern Pennsylvania at Lake Silkworth and spent a lot of time in Newport Township, Glen Lyon, Shaytown area, because that's where my parents were born and raised. So I spent half of my life up here, growing up here. And I was really very happy that my parents did that, gave us an appreciation for two very different cultures. I was raised in a very metropolitan, urbane culture in Philadelphia during the school year, and then during the summers and vacations up here. And this was and continues to be a working class culture predominantly. And I grew to respect people and judge them on their character rather than their degrees. And some of the most phenomenal people in my life have come from up here, and not all of them are relatives. I think of Michael O'Malley, who was the editor of Pennsylvania Heritage Magazine for many, many years. He's from Tamaqua, and, you know, we had this connection. I think of Robert Janisov, who was my predecessor at Luzerne County Community College, and we developed a very, very strong friendship over Pennsylvania history and especially anthracite history. I think of Clark Schweitzer, who was at Wyoming Seminary for so many years. In fact, for me, Sem and Clark became synonymous. But what Clark has done with local history up here, with his website and in the teaching of it, has just been remarkable. And these are just a few of the people who, you know, I've come to know and love over the years. Unfortunately, Michael and Bob have passed on, but Clark is still very much around and doing history.
Did you have any interest in the Revolutionary War history of our region while you were growing up or at all?
That's a very interesting question. My family, both sides of my family, did not immigrate to this country from Lithuania and Poland until the 1870s. So the history that I was taught up here necessarily was about the 19th and early 20th century, because that was our family's history. And my first interest, at least up here, was the anthracite history and learning about it, because it was synonymous with my family's history. Now, at the same time, I was also raised in Philadelphia. And you can't help but, if you're interested in history, learning about the colonial period, the Revolution, and the early Republic, because it's all around you. So that was another thing I was very fortunate about, that I was exposed to the different types of history, because the Commonwealth, the Keystone, it's called the Keystone State because it's the keystone of the nation. And it wasn't just the keystone of the nation during the Revolution and during the Constitution-making period. It was the keystone of the Industrial Revolution, too, because of the coal mining and the steel mills and the natural deposits of anthracite that we had here and iron ore. So the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania really was significant in our country's development.
Well, Bill, you are a serious academic historian, and yet you have engaged, and we're going to learn about, the public-facing history that you are writing about from your own experience. How do you do both as a historian?
I think what they call scholarly history, and the people who write it, they call them collectively the academy. And I have seen a watershed change in the academy since I earned my PhD back in 1993. Some of that change has not been very good. And I do talk about younger historians today who are extremely critical, and not only of their peers' work, but of the individual themselves. I mean, they do launch personal attacks, and I don't respect that. I think the historians that I had in my training, people like Gordon Wood and Michael Zuckerman and Richard Beeman, these are all gentlemen historians. And yes, they could be critical, but I think they drew the line at personal animosity, and that's the way it should be. And that's just one part of it. I mean, the scholarship on the American Revolution has been tremendous over the last, I don't know, 30 years. Just the other day, a historian by the name of Danielle Allen, who is a professor of early American history at Harvard University, came out with a study on the Declaration of Independence that talks about the importance of the document for us today. And shortly before that, she did a wonderful work on an English duke who apparently collaborated with Thomas Paine on a series of letters and articles, I believe they're called the Junius Letters, which were forwarding many of the causes of American independence. And this is a sea change in the historiography on Thomas Paine, because all of us thought that Paine didn't start writing anything until 1771, but here it's clear that his writing on issues that matter to him on human rights began as early as 1768. And I just actually purchased a 6-volume set which contained many of these letters, and I can't wait to get into them, because I do want to do a very serious scholarly work on Thomas Paine, who I feel has largely been ignored because of the Age of Reason and his attack on organized religion.
And we will get to it, I hope. In your work at the park, you often portray Thomas Paine.
I do. In fact, I would be there today and Saturday the 4th portraying Thomas Paine and rallying the crowd for American independence if it wasn't so hot. But yes, public history has been very important to me, because I started my career as a prep school teacher, and public historians have the responsibility of making the history understandable and also interesting and relevant to youngsters. It's the only way you're going to interest them in it. And Independence Park is a public history place. That's what we do. I mean, we see people from all over the world there, and we explain the history of colonial America, Revolutionary America, and the early Republic. And I think we do it very, very well. And when I say we, I used to be a summer seasonal ranger there back in the 1980s and absolutely loved it. And then came the 35-year hiatus of teaching and museum work. But since I retired in 2021, I've been back there as a volunteer, and I absolutely love it.
How are rangers trained? What are the qualifications?
Many rangers will come to the park system having been summer seasonal rangers when they were in college. They can go in one of two directions. There are those who like the natural resource parks, Sequoia, Yosemite, Arcadia, places like that. And then there are those who like the history parks and the Civil War battlefields. I came to it through history. Many of the rangers who are at Independence have also come to Independence through history and history degrees. But there are some who, and we jokingly call them tree huggers, natural resource park people, but they've come to appreciate Independence for the history that occurred there. Now, when you come to Independence, you're put through some pretty rigorous training. You have to learn the history of all the sites. Then you have to write your own programs. You're not just going to blindly take people through Independence Hall. So if a ranger takes you through the hall, they have already spent months, if not years, studying Independence Hall and the history that they're going to interpret. And every single ranger has a different theme on their tour. if I take you through the hall, I'm going to focus on Independence Hall as the place where popular sovereignty in our government originated, and it is a hall of the people. Others will have different themes in their tours, but all of them have to be reviewed by the supervisors, by the administrators. They all have to be historically accurate. And having been in Europe and seeing some of the interpretation that is done there, not from national parks, but from site-specific places like Versailles, it just is an example. We far surpass the quality of interpretation. We really do.
The complex then is made up of, you mentioned the sites, so it's not just Independence Hall.
Yeah, there are 13 total, of, I believe 13 sites now that we operate, unfortunately, because the National Park Service has had its budget severely cut. We can only open 6 of them. So those sites that are open this summer are Independence Hall, Congress Hall, the Liberty Bell Center, Franklin Court. We have just reopened the second Bank of the United States. That's our portrait gallery. And we have just reopened the first Bank of the United States. And we interpret the economy of colonial and revolutionary America in there. So we're lucky to have those sites open.
We might as well get right to it. Talk to us about the situation with the Washington House.
Right. Yeah, this has been a very difficult situation for me personally because one of my very deep interests as a Quaker and because my religious denomination has played such a very important role in the abolition of slavery and civil rights, and a lot of my writing has dealt with that issue, the President's House site has become a very painful thing for me. The President House site is essentially a ghost house, which means it is a metal door frame and metal window frames mounted on a brick foundation, and it marks the site where President George Washington and John Adams lived and met with their cabinets during Philadelphia's time as the nation's capital, which was that decade of the 1790s. During that time, in the Washington administration, roughly 1790 to 1797, Washington brought 9 slaves with him from Mount Vernon to serve his staff and his wife. They were the cook, Hercules, Oney Judge, who was Martha Washington's personal servant. Those were probably the most outstanding of them. And the others were coachmen, regular servants. And we tell their stories. We tell the stories of what their life was like before they came to Philadelphia, how it changed. And we deal with the issue of slavery, and it's not a pretty issue. And because of that, the Trump administration has decided to rewrite history. And this went back and forth for 2 years' time. And the final say on it, we just found out right before the 4th, is that a cleansed narration or interpretation has to go up on the signage. In fact, there's an acknowledgement that George Washington had these slaves, but there is nothing about his ownership, really, his treatment, the way he managed these slaves. And you cannot do that responsibly as a historian, and we as an institution in the park cannot do that. And this is an issue that has legs to it. It's going to be an ongoing controversy in the country. I'm in the middle, but it is an issue that is very troubling to me.
When you go to volunteer, are you at the same site each time?
No, and that's a fortunate thing. Back in the 1980s, we had 4 different districts in the park, and you were wedded to that district for the entire summer. But now, the way the park is set up, mostly because we only have 4 sites fully open, usually during the year, we don't have the first or second bank open, everybody just interchanges in those sites. So I'm guaranteed to have at least a couple tours in Independence Hall, couple tours in Congress Hall, and then either I will be at the Liberty Bell Center or Franklin Court. So I get to see all of them, or the major ones that are open. This summer I will be at the second bank because I've done some training on that. And again, it's a portrait gallery, so I'm going to be telling the story of some of the founding fathers. I will not be in the first bank. There's a whole coterie of rangers that are handling that, and a lot of that's self-guided too.
When you take people through on these tours, do you notice that they have aha moments, that going through Independence Hall, it's history they know from books, but suddenly their faces light up?
Mm-hmm. For me, taking people through Independence Hall is a privilege, and I say it as soon as we walk into the assembly room, and you see the faces light up, because the very first thing I say is it was here in 1776 that our nation was born. It was here in 1787 that our federal constitution was drafted. No matter how many times the history of this room is told, it never loses its special meaning for us as Americans and often inspires those visiting from other countries. And that is why it is a privilege to share that history with you. And then I'll go back into the revolutionary period and talk about how the founding fathers, what they really wanted was they wanted their rights as Englishmen to be respected, and they weren't. Specifically, when Congress passed the Townshend Acts in response to the Boston Tea Party in 1774, they shut down all of Boston's political assemblies, they suspended due process of law, and they made it legal for British soldiers to quarter in the homes of private citizens without their consent. Those are all violations of the English Constitution. And that's what they were fighting for. They were fighting to have their liberties under the English Constitution restored. In fact, it really wasn't until 1776, with Thomas Paine, and one can argue even later in July, where that decision went. I mean, obviously on July the 2nd, 250 years ago, is the day that Congress voted on Richard Henry Lee's resolution that these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states. And it carried 12 votes for, none against, one abstention. New York abstained, but it carried on that day. And for the rest of the day until or through July the 4th, the Second Continental Congress and the delegates spent making 67 changes on Jefferson's Declaration of Independence. And then finally, they voted on it and adopted it on the 4th of July. So actually, either one of those dates could easily be celebrated for our nation's birth. But you ask about the aha moments. I think those people who are really interested in history are not aware that the Second Continental Congress and the American people really were asking to have their rights respected as Englishmen. They weren't talking about a completely independent country, but when it came to the point where their rights weren't being respected, and then King George III declared them in avowed and open rebellion and sent over thousands more troops, you know, that was the breaking point. And I will even say that in 1775, the Congress wrote an olive branch petition to King George III asking for a redress of grievances. And many of the men who sat in that Congress generally believed that George III was going to resolve the conflict, but the American people didn't. And one of the reasons I love Tom Paine so much is because he was the spokesman for the common people. Because in January of 1776, when his pamphlet Common Sense was printed, you could divide the American people in very unequal thirds. 45%, and there's only about 2 million people on the eastern seaboard at this period of time who are white. There's 2.5, but 500,000 are black slaves. So there are about 2 million white people who were living in what would become the United States. 45% of them wanted independence from Great Britain. 20% wanted to remain in the empire, and 35% didn't care. Sound familiar? Didn't care because they didn't understand the relevance of the conflict to their own lives. Well, it was Paine's genius to write this pamphlet, Common Sense, explaining in very, very understandable terms why we have to separate from Great Britain. And that pamphlet, and it's recognized by all scholars in the academy, that pamphlet was the deciding factor because it mobilized the common people to fight a war against Great Britain. Now, Thomas Jefferson, Second Continental Congress, could write all the documents they want. But if the people don't understand the issue, well, they're not going to fight the war.
Was Paine an orator, too?
A very nasty one. Paine is a very complex figure. He was a tax collector in England, but he circulated in a very enlightened group that included scientists, statesmen, and politicians, both British and American. Ben Franklin is the individual he made a friendship with that steered him towards America. But he had a very tragic life, unsuccessful in two marriages. The first wife died in childbirth, so he lost the child too. And he developed problems with alcohol. He was, interestingly, raised a Quaker and had a soft spot for the Quakers until he came to this country. And the Philadelphia Quakers adhered to their peace testimony. They refused to fight. And Paine believed that there were some reasons that are worth fighting for and even dying for. So he distanced himself from the Society of Friends. But he didn't really care much about his appearance. He's probably only about 5'7 or 5'8, very small man, big pendulous nose, ruddy face from all the rum and Madeira that he'd drink, and smelled to high heaven. Didn't take baths very often. Wore, you know, clothes that were pretty raggedy, but he was a brilliant writer. And if you read Common Sense, the words literally jump off the page. I mean, we're talking about things like, "O ye who love mankind, the blood of the slain, the weeping voice of nature cries, 'Tis time to part. Freedom hath been hunted round the globe. Asia and Africa have expelled her, and Mother England regards her as a stranger. Oh, receive the fugitive and prepare in time an asylum for all mankind. Independence, American now, or you will be selling your children into slavery.'" That's pretty passionate stuff. It really is. And people can understand that kind of language, and they were drawn to it.
You said that you would be there today at the park, but it's too hot. It was hot, if we believe the play 1776. Did that matter, that it was hot in those days in Philadelphia?
Well, it's kind of a half-truth that I'm not there today. But yes, it was hot, very hot. And these conventions were secret meetings. And that meant that the windows had to be closed and the doors had to be shut. So it was sweltering, too. It was terrible. And that part of Philadelphia had horse stables and taverns, and people would dump their refuse in the local Dock Creek, so it smelled to high heaven. We know that during both of those conventions, some of the street keepers dumped gravel on the cobblestone roads so it would muffle the noise of the carriages so it wouldn't be as loud. It wasn't a pretty sight. It really wasn't.
Dr. William Cushatus, historian, educator, and author, speaking with us about his new book titled Independence National Historical Park, An Insider's History, issued by Schiffer Books. For more information, on the web, schifferbooks.com, S-C-H-I-F-F-E-R, schifferbooks.com. And to learn more about Dr. Cushatus and his work, historylive.net. historylive.net. And Dr. Cushatus' name is spelled K-A-S-H-A-T-U-S. K-A-S-H-A-T-U-S. This is the first part of a two-part conversation. We'll hear the second installment tomorrow on Art Scene.